And then without further ado, the man that has really helped basically put this whole thing together, Stereo Session, all these records mean a lot to him. He's done a great job for all these years getting it together. I'm really excited. He's been talking about this record all day today, so I'm super excited. I'm going to bring up program manager Jared J.B. Boyd. Yeah, louder. Jared J.B. Boyd.
Yeah, thank you. Joe, is this your stuff here? I don't want to sit on it and put my booty on it. All right, I put my booty on a lot of stuff, but not that. Yeah. Cool. How's everyone doing? Man, these things start later and later every year. I feel like I need to get back in the groove. Welcome back to Stereo Sessions Season 4, right? Season 4. I know y'all raised your hand a little earlier. Raise your hand again if you've been to one of these before. Fantastic. Good to see everybody back. Great to be back in the Memphis Listening Lab. To have the amazing support of all of our sponsors. But it's also amazing to dig back into jazz. Whenever we talk about jazz, whenever we play jazz, whenever we feature jazz, particularly jazz that is rooted in Memphis, rooted in home, we get an outpouring of support that is amazing. And I want to make sure that we acknowledge the history of our station. We are born of the jazz lover, and so this is important. It's prescient. And it's imperative that we keep that heritage going. And it's imperative that we speak of something that I feel like is truly a hidden history of Memphis. And when you talk about the station with the city soul, the home of the birthplace of soul and rock and roll and the home of the blues and B.B. King and Elvis Presley and all that, we have to talk about Phineas Newborn. We have to talk about the Newborn family. We have to talk about Willie Mitchell, and we have to talk about the Steinbergs, and we have to talk about Hank Crawford, and we have to talk about all of these many, many people, Frank Strozier and Booker Little, and on and on and on and on and on. There's so many people who have an incredible lineage that gave way to the rock and roll, that gave way to the blues, gave it to the soul. I think of, hell, I was with Charles Lloyd a couple years ago, and he talked about why there's such a deep overlap that sometimes you can't even distinguish between the blues and jazz when you speak of music in Memphis. And, you know, a lot of those guys from that era, when you say the blues, they mean jazz. When you say jazz, they mean blues. And so I want to really get to the nitty gritty of extracting where the disconnect is and where that nebulous connective tissue is, where we can connect this sort of, it's almost like a dead language, like Latin. It is a foundation of what we live on, but we aren't speaking of it in the same way that the people who are foundational did. So I'm watching you. You know a lot, so I'm making sure. If I mess up, you tell me. Say, JB, shut the hell up. You don't know what you're talking about. But so before I do that, I want to bring up Joe Restivo because he knows a heck of a lot.
How y'all doing?
In some ways, we've been here before in the sense that, you know, when I picked that record to do a Stereo Sessions on, if you weren't here, it's probably been 2 years almost now that we did Young Men from Memphis, which is a jazz record, which is like kind of an all-star record in the late 50s. It was released on United Artists, and it has Phineas and Calvin Newborn on it. Phineas Jr., I want to make that distinction early on. Calvin Newborn. Frank Strozier, Booker Little, and several other
George Coleman,
Jamil
Nasser, who we're going to hear tonight.
I said, you know, if I'm going to pick a jazz record, let's just knock all these guys out
right in
one fell swoop because I know that people are so passionate about jazz. If I miss any of them on this first one, I'm going to be doing jazz records for the rest of Stereo Sessions. And so I strategically picked that record so that we could have a deep conversation about several important players in Memphis jazz history. But there's this one guy that I just could not move on from. And so we need to take a deeper look because he's really important at the intersection of a lot of the different amazing things that are going on in music in Memphis and in jazz. And so I was like, if we're going to come back to jazz, we have to start with Phineas Newborn Jr. And to have a deeper conversation. When you hear that name and when you think about that evolution of this series, how do you respond to just my thought process with that?
Well, first of all, I want to thank everybody for coming. And this artist we're about to listen to means incredible. He's one of my superheroes. And his brother was a literal I'm a guitar player, if any of you are aware of that. And I'm a big jazz guitar player fan and a jazz guitar player practitioner. But Calvin was a guy I used to go see, and he made an indelible mark on me. But his brother is the man we're going to hear tonight. And, oh, by the way, we're going to listen to Calvin as well. Calvin has some of the best solos on record. And Calvin's not that well recorded, but we're going to hear some great Calvin Newborn, too. When you asked me about doing this, I was very excited, number one, because I'm a huge fan of Phineas Newborn. But what I want to kind of present to you guys tonight is if you were going to pick the Phineas Newborn record to do, the obvious pick would not be this one. It would be World of Piano. It would be a contemporary album from a little bit later than this period. This record came out in 1957. Phineas Newborn ended up in Los Angeles and recording for, hopefully I'll get to talk a little bit about this stuff or give you some backstory. But he ended up in Los Angeles and recorded for the Contemporary label. And the Contemporary record label was a much more jazz aficionado-oriented label. RCA, which is Phineas's Rainbow, the label that it came out on, was a big label. Elvis Presley is on this label. They have a huge country division. So World of Piano that he recorded later is by most people's, a lot of experts consider that to be his magnus opus, and for good reason. He's a much more mature, polished artist. He's working with a very established rhythm section. He's recording in a traditional piano trio format. So why did I pick this record? Because to me, this record represents the Memphis Phineas Newborn. This is the Phineas Newborn when he was young and he was excited and he goes to New York and he makes a huge impact. I mean, like sensational impact almost immediately. And I wanted to present for you guys, if you're not familiar, even if you are familiar, what that is like. And what you're going to hear is a young man who's beyond talented. Like, he's a super genius. And people throw that word around. He's a genius. This man is a genius. This man is a musical genius of unparalleled quality. I don't know of another, and I've been in this business a long time. I play with people all the time that are brilliant, but this is on another level. He played saxophone. He played all the brass instruments. He played all the woodwind instruments. He played vibes. He played bass. He could have been a great saxophonist that we would be having a conversation about now. He could have been a great trumpet player that we would be having a conversation now. He just chose the piano because the piano represents the entire breadth of musicality. He can create symphonies on the piano, which is what you're going to hear tonight. You're going to hear this stuff. So that's why I chose this record, because this is the first RCA record. And real quick, before, he did make a record on Atlantic. He got to New York in 1956. He made a record immediately on Atlantic Records, but it wasn't the record he wanted to make, because Atlantic Records was like, no, we're going to put you with an established New York rhythm section. So after the Atlantic record, he signs the deal with RCA. He made four records for RCA. This is the first of the RCA records. And this is the record he wanted to make first. This is the one he wanted, because he got to work with his homies. Calvin Newborn, his brother, Jamil Nasser, who at the time was, before he converted to Islam, was known as George Joyner. The Joyner family is a very great musical family here in Memphis. These were his boys. These were his partners. They had been on tour. They had played in Memphis. They were like, here we are. They came to New York together. They were so excited. And then, there's a bunch of trio dates or trio cuts on this record that we'll hear. And that's the band, you know. And then they rounded out with Philly Joe Jones on drums. So that's the record I wanted to, that's why I chose this record, you know.
Well, I'm glad you said it four or five times. Joe chose the record. If you hate it, he chose the
you
record.
You ain't going to hate it.
I said, Joe, we have to do Phineas Newborn. He chose this record. No, I'm teasing. But to that last point, Philly Joe Jones on the drums. You know, a couple weeks ago, we were here in this same spot having a memorial for Stanley Booth. And a few months ago, I'd picked up Rhythm Oil by Stanley Booth. rest in peace to him. David was asking me to come and spend some time with him before he passed, and I hate that I didn't get the opportunity to. But I was thrilled that we got to memorialize him here in this space. But reading his chapter in Rhythm Oil about Phineas Newborn Jr., there was a lot about the push and pull between junior and senior. There is overtones about the assertion that, you know, Phineas Newborn Sr. as a drummer would have loved to have played alongside his son on this record, that his dream, his mission for having children was to have a family band, and to see his sons Calvin and Phineas Jr. become stars in their own right, but not necessarily keep that family unit together on record, was a bit to his dismay. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I just have what the rec or the people that have investigated this stuff and knew the family. And I'm to that point, how many of you guys have heard of Phineas Newborn before you decided to come? Okay, how many of you guys saw Phineas play? Okay, that's quite. How many of you knew Phineas Newborn personally? Okay.
His grandniece is in the back.
We got grandniece?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Senior was a great band leader and wanted to be a part of his son's career, his life. And I get uncomfortable speaking about, because this is very personal stuff. Yeah, I wasn't there. But from... I don't know if he's here, Jim Spake. Let me borrow Jameel Nassar's amazing book, Upright Bass. And Jameel Nassar speaks to it. So I'll kind of sort of paraphrase what he says in the book.
I need that. I didn't know
this
that.
Book yeah, is the business. Anywho, Senior went. Essentially, Phineas is like, I have to leave. He goes to Tennessee State, which Tennessee A&I, HBC school. He ends up, I think he ended up doing a year at Lemoyne. Then he goes in the Army for 3 years from 53 to 55. So he comes back home. He goes back to the family band, the family business. Okay, think of it that way. And he's like, I got to go. I got to go to New York. He knows where his destiny is calling him. And his dad doesn't want him to go. I mean, by all accounts, his dad wants him to stay. We're in the family band. We got you got your brother, but he's like, no, I got to go. So he goes to New York. His dad follows him. I'll manage you. I'll be your manager. And George Joyner at the time, but Jameel Nassar was in the B.B. King Orchestra. This man playing electric bass at the time, and a lot of great jazz musicians from here went through the B.B. King Orchestra. And Phineas goes, look, I'm moving to New York, and I want you to come with me. And he says, okay. And he's got a regular gig. He's got a job with B.B. King. He's got a primo position. He goes, all right, I'll drop what I'm doing. I'm going to move to New York with my guy, who I know is a genius, my homie. We're going to go to New York. Well, Phineas Senior comes with him, and he's going to be their manager. Well, they're in a hotel, and he's trying to work out in advance, and all he managed. And Jameel's kind of been, he's been on the road with BB. He's been used to, good treatment, for the time, especially, the time and being black in that time. He was used to being treated a certain way. They get to New York, and Senior worked out a $10 buyout. He was like, no, man, $10 advance. He's like, we got to get a manager. And they did. His name is Willard Alexander, and he negotiated a $1,000 advance. Okay, so that let them know dad's not cutting it. But it's heartbreaking, because how do you tell your father, hey, man, you're fired? That's what happened. And from that point on, Senior's longingly following his son's meteoric rise and wanting to be there as a drummer too, because he was a drummer, but he just didn't have, he was a blues drummer. He was a good show drummer. He was a good blues drummer for the local scene, but he wasn't Philly Joe Jones. He wasn't Kenny Clark, he wasn't, a myriad of drum, they went through, when they were on on the road. This is the drummers they played with. And this was Jamil Nasser, Phineas Newborn, Calvin Newborn. When they went on the road in 1956, they were working with Kenny Clarke, Roy Haynes, Denzel Best, Ron Jefferson, Shadow Wilson, Philly Joe Jones, Ferdinand Everett, Alvin Stoller, Larry Ritchie, and Kenny Dennis. They were all his drummers. These are the best of the best, okay? Because nobody could hang with Phineas's time because they were playing Phineas. You'll hear in the record these incredible tempos. They couldn't keep up with him. His time feel was too amazing, too good, too incredible, and they would just leave these drummers in the dust. They were crushing them. So they were running through them. President Lauterbach talks about in his book, it was almost like a Spinal Tap thing with the drummer. They were just going through drummers. They were wearing them out, you know. And Dad wasn't going to be able to. If they can't hang, you think Dad's going to hang? So anyway, that whole dynamic is just part of the story. It's part of the legacy. It's part of the mythos. And it's also like personalizes this artist. You get to know that this was a young man who was like having to make some really tough decisions, you know?
Yeah, definitely in a nomadic sense, you know. And also I want to, since we're talking about his father, and I'll give tons of credit to his father, he was a known quantity in Memphis.
Oh, absolutely. He had a music store.
Yeah. Someone who, you know, allegedly he sent B.B. King to mentor Calvin, to take Calvin down to get his first guitar, because apparently Calvin started on piano and could not keep up with his brother.
That's right.
Apparently Calvin was more motivated to play music because he thought women would be interested in him. Phineas was more like, I'm, you know, y'all catch up with me later. I'm going to continue to practice. Y'all go have fun playing, right. You know, hide and go get it and come holler at me later on. But his mother as well was a known quantity in the community, someone who was sort of a glue person and pushed him to play piano at such a proficiency. But also got a lot of awards for just her advocacy for other artists that are in the community.
Yes.
One of which, and this came up during Preston's talk with Robert Gordon a couple weeks ago, and this comes up in a lot of books, Elvis Presley was a good friend of the Newborn family.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I mean, was anyone at the Lauterbach thing, a few of y'all? It was really cool. And, Calvin used to tell me, about, you know, hanging with Elvis, and Elvis would come over, and it's like, really? Did he? Yes, he did. Because Lauterbach was able to substantiate all this stuff. He was able to find other people corroborating, you know, where he was, and that you know, at the Flamingo Room, for instance, or at the Mitchell Hotel, you know, that Elvis was kind of investigating, and one of the people that in the group of people that he became friends with was the Newborn family. I mean, it's almost too
well, you see pictures of Calvin, you know, leaping into the air with his guitar, and you think, okay, I see this level of showmanship. Had, if implanted onto a white face, would take the world by storm.
Yes,
and it sounds like it did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
but it starts in the Black community here, and it starts in those starts in the Flamingo Room, and with bands like the Newborn Family. I mean, that's where the founder, and you know, Trigg Missionary Baptist, you know, and Brewster, and all, right, you know, that's right, where, right. It, and that I highly recommend that book, by the way.
These places that Elvis went, we won't spend much time on Elvis. Yeah. That's a different stereo session that'll never happen. But I do want to talk a bit about this record before we jump into it, and the critical response to Phineas Newborn's early output. You know, I was reading a bit in the Booth book again about the critical response, that there were a lot of, like, downbeat. There were a lot of jazz critics who saw very much this proficiency and this excellence, this drive to be the greatest pianist of the time, and felt like, and I'll underscore this, if you will, from a white journalist of the time's perspective, that there was not enough soul in this music. That's why it didn't connect.
I think that's insane. I think anybody who would listen to this man's work and say there's no soul is, I don't have anything to say about them. I'm not interested in what they have to say. I mean,
may they all rest in peace, because they were writing in the 50s.
Your ears are, I mean, it's just, I know what you're talking about. I've heard, you know, terms cold, it's crazy. I don't know, because his music is so. I think here's my theory on that. I think Phineas had so many gifts that you can get blinded, and I think this is what happened to some of these critics. They get blinded by the virtuosity, because there's a tremendous amount of virtuosity, but that doesn't take away the swing feel, the time feel. His time feel is perfect. His swing feel is perfect. His swing feel to me is on par with Wynton Kelly and Ray Bryant, two of the most hard swinging jazz pianists that ever lived. I'm a huge fan of this stuff, but they didn't have Phineas's virtuosity. So you can go, oh, he's playing all this romantic, because then Phineas had all this like classical romantic piano language, but he also had the traditional gospel black and blues language, and he had Bud Powell's language, so this like New York bebop language. So he's got all this stuff going on, so it's easy to go, because I think what a lot of people do and a lot of critics do specifically, and we artists, we do this too, musicians do this, oh, well, he's just that. You know, you look at a musician, you go, oh, well, he just is that guy or that gal. But the thing about it with Phineas, if you do that, you try to put him in a corner or peck, you're missing, like, when he does a slow blues. And it's, like, simple. He plays very phrase-oriented, simple language, beautiful, simple phrases. But yes, what we're going to hear today, he's going to like knock your socks off with virtuosity. So that's just whatever. I don't even take that, you know.
Well, you know, it brings a lot of questions to me, some more controversial than others.
But and real quick, yeah. Phineas was a great boogie-woogie pianist. He had this whole other boogie-woogie thing. Like Mead Lux Lewis, Albert Ammons, he had this whole, like, he could just do that. And he doesn't really do much of that on these records. But they say he could just do Boogie Woogie Piano Player all night long. I got to work with Mose Vincent, and I don't know if anybody y'all remember Mose. So I got to work when I was a stupid kid and didn't know what the hell I was doing. I got to work with this guy who was like a master Boogie Woogie pianist. So I kind of know what that is. And Phineas could do that all day long. So, again, that's the most soulful thing, you know, deep. Rooted thing in the world, you know.
Well, it begs a few questions, at least for me in hindsight, about a music form that is uniquely American, uniquely in some ways rural and urban.
Yeah,
it's post-industrial, post-slavery, post-World War, but it's also making a turn from very streetwise, underground, colloquial music into what we know today as America's classical music. And for a black man from Memphis, Tennessee, to achieve perfection in that realm, yeah, maybe is too much for some to wrap their mind around.
I think so. I think that is true.
And so,
locally, for sure. And that's why people like Harold Mayburn, I went to school in New York, and I'd go see Harold Mayburn, and he was an acolyte of Phineas Newborn, and I remember hanging out with him, and I mean, it would literally 2 hours, like at the club drinking beer, and then we got on the subway, he's still going, Phineas Newborn, and it's like, he said, I left Memphis in 1955, I'm not putting up with Jim Crow, I'm not doing that. I'm George Coleman, I'm a genius, I'm changing saxophone, I'm not putting up with this, bye, see ya. Y'all have it. Y'all enjoy it. And, you know, luckily there were places like they could at least go to New York. And, like, we'll talk, you know, I don't know if we'll talk about it, but New York was tough on Phineas, okay? But, you know, a lot of Memphis musicians did find sanctuary there. Like, we've mentioned a few of them. And Phineas ended up in L.A. and was there longer. And it, you know, at least we have this work still, thankfully. But he ended up coming home. But I totally understand. I would have done the same thing.
And it's maybe sad to think that there is no Stax or Sun or, you know, a High or even a Malico or there's no house of jazz that could have come from this city, because maybe we weren't ready yet to accept all these amazing,
maybe
our most brilliant musicians created a music that we are not
to accept it when some, you know, and even like, I mean, I remember Carla Thomas telling me, it's like, yeah, we were making hits and everybody, we couldn't get any press. We couldn't get any, I mean, that's a whole nother subject, but like, yes. I mean, I think especially when you're talking about somebody who's like executing and, you know, like, here's a guy who's a completely, like, absorbed Chopin's music. And again, Bud Powell and Boogie Woogie and this and gospel. And, like, it is kind of overwhelming. It's like, and you even read in the liner notes and you read in, like, what? How did this guy do this out of, you know, they're almost, like, sort of flabbergasted. Like, where's this guy from? Like, how do we not know? Because it's like there's also a thought that you have to go through like sort of like an institutional thing. Like you have to go through like conservatories or it's like, how could a person develop this amount of, you know, dexterity and like musical genius, you know, in Memphis, you know, that doesn't compute. Even I'm talking about the New York critics, you know, the national people who were sometimes unfair, like we talked about.
So this is the Old Testament of Memphis music.
Yeah.
So let's listen to it.
Well, can we talk a little bit about the sides? Are we going to do that?
We've been talking. I think they're ready to listen. But you got a point.
But I know you. I know. Just real quick. I promise you. Real quick.
I want to make sure we get out of here.
I know.
Because the Stanley Booth thing was long. I want to be short.
We did a bunch of side notes. I just want to at least address some of these cuts. We're going to do the first side first, right?
Yeah. The first side is first. Yes.
Well, I was confused because there was talk about doing.
Yeah.
All
right. I'm just messing. I'm all just teasing.
The first cut is an original cut. And it is a showcase of the first cut you're going to hear is an original composition, and you're going to just I'm the man, okay? Intro it's fast, and Philly Joe Jones is right there playing brushes, and notice the arrangements because Calvin and these are arranged pieces because they had been on tour they had gone on the Birdland tour, they had been working all across the country. This was a well-oiled machine. The second cut is an homage to Nat King Cole, Come to Baby Do. It is, Phineas was a huge Nat King Cole fan, and this is a homage to him. The second tune is a solo piece, Stairway to the Stars, a beautiful ballad, and you're going to hear his romantic classical, you know, influences. And then the last tune on the side one is a piece by Harold Land called Land's End. And Harold Land and Phineas would end up working down the road. I've always fascinated. How did he know about Harold Land at this point? But he was obviously very interested in Harold Land's writing at this point in 1956. So he was already in tune with some of these West Coast guys he had eventually kind of moved to LA and spend more time in LA. So that's the first side. We'll talk about the second side.
Awesome.
On a break. Cool. Anybody catch the quote he made at the end of Stairway to the Stars?
Is
not
that
one?
Is it my ears ringing? What is that? Do you hear that? Anyone hear that?
Tinnitus, man. You got ear. You got ear damage.
Is that outside or? Oh, my bad. I'm sorry. Hey.
Oh, there we go.
Well, go forth, young man. You got a legacy to uphold.
The next Phineas.
Absolutely. I thought that was Santa Claus.
No, Phineas quoted Over the Rainbow. Something over the rainbow. He would, there's all kind of little musical puzzles throughout his thing. I mean, one thing that I noticed just from listening to that side is Phineas had like a huge dynamic range. That means he'd get real loud, he'd get real soft. And if you listen to the classical masterworks, Chopin, Rachmaninoff, Beethoven sonatas, Franz Liszt, they have big, loud, soft. But that's not typical of a lot of jazz pianists like Bud Powell. But Phineas had big, soft. And then he had color. On the piano, it's hard to make color because you're just pressing the button. It's not like a saxophone or a wind instrument. You can't bend notes like a guitar. He can create these beautiful colorations like a classical pianist. I'm a classical piano nerd, even though I'm not a classical pianist. But when I hear Phineas, that's what I hear. I hear he reminds me of Martha Argerich or, you know, Michelangelo.
Calvin, you're a drummer. You think you could keep up with him?
No. Okay.
I believe in you. I believe in you. I mean, it was brilliant hearing that. How was it in the listening room? I heard my record might have been a little dirty. Did it sound okay in there? Give it up for the Memphis Listening Lab for these facilities.
I had another copy I could have brought.
It's just listening to it out here, I heard so much texture in, I mean, the physicality of his playing.
Yes.
You know.
But he was a small man.
And another point, speaking of, that I didn't even consider, didn't think of, again, for these facilities, the Memphis Listening Lab, I was hanging over there with Jamie Harmon, and I was like, look above your head. Phineas Newborn was right there in the beautiful picture by Pat Rayner right there in the corner.
Oh,
so it was like a halo over his head. Looked like he was playing at the Peabody by the fountain. So I think probably a little later in life. So a nice little reminder that it all comes back to home. And so before we jump into side two, I kind of want to talk a bit more about the man. And one note that you made about the dynamic between senior and junior that I don't know if you know, it's mentioned in the Stanley Booth book, is that when Phineas Jr. was at Tennessee State, all of his advisors saw his brilliance and recommended that he go to Juilliard. And his father allegedly said no. He'd wanted to keep the family band together.
Yeah.
And that was one of the big regrets of his life,
right,
that he did not make that jump earlier to get his name and his sound out there.
I mean, one wonders. I don't know. I mean, that's a very personal dynamic between family. What that would have been, you know, counterfactual. What if he went to Juilliard? What that would have looked like, I don't know. Would he become a concert pianist? And then maybe, I mean, but then we wouldn't have Phineas Rainbow and Phineas, you know, Fabulous Phineas and all the contemporary records and the Roulette record. And then I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, he certainly, there was a deep rooted, that's normal stuff, man. I mean, I get it, you know. You want your kids with you. You don't, you know, you're afraid. You're worried about your children.
I don't think that's probably unique to any family from here, you know, wanting the best for a child that's born and raised in this environment. You know,
yes.
This is what you know. What's the lesser of the two evils?
And then you're leaving that safety of the family dynamic. What's going to happen to him when he goes to New York? Will he get involved? You know, it's New York. I mean, my father's from Brooklyn, New York, so I've had a connect. There's my folks are here, Mom and Dad, Ernie and Mary Ellen. So I had a, we would go up and visit the family when I was a kid. So I, when I, and I went to college and graduated from the New York, from New School University. So I was fairly familiar with the city when I went up, but man, it's crazy, man. It's a crazy place. You know, it's crazy people up there. They want to take your money and they want to get, they want you to buy dope and they want you to do this and they want you to do that. And if you had no experience with that, yeah, I would be worried sick over, I'm sure y'all were worried when I was up, you know, y'all, you're worried about your kids, man. Right?
For sure.
That's normal. And, you know, maybe there was a little bit of that, like, you know, when your kid's maybe a little bit better athlete or a lot better athlete than you are, and you played, you know, basketball or baseball, and then now he's awesome, and you want to ride that wave with him a little bit, or her.
Yeah.
There might have been some of that going on, you know?
Well, I want to think of a responsible way to speak about this. And, you know, when I write, when I was a full-time journalist, you know, a lot of times, you know, you might get Walgreens reaching out about some incredible new pill or new study that they've got in front of them. And I say, okay, well, how can I write about this as a trend so that I'm not promoting Walgreens and their cool thing? I'm having a larger dialogue about something that's going on that's widespread. I think I'd take the same approach. Phineas Newborn is not unlike a lot of jazz musicians from his era, that he had quite a lot of demons, whether psychological or induced by drugs or some mixture of the two. I don't love this at all, but I would be remiss if I didn't take a pause to dedicate some bit of this conversation to a mental health piece that I think is important to all creatives. And important to this particular piece of work, and important to telling the context and the color of this story about this gentleman. There was quite a lot about his story, his history, that is tragic, I would say, but also mental health is at the forefront of that. And he spent a lot of time between various institutions. I'd say Bellevue being the most probably prominent mental health institution in our American lore. He was there at some point or in multiple stints. You have a response to that?
I'm not a mental health professional, but I can tell you I've been in the music business for a very long time, and I've seen a lot of musicians fall by the wayside. I mean, even when I was a kid, I have friends that are dead, you know, from drugs. And I know people that who were perfectly fine and then maybe started, you know, doing psychedelics or whatever, and then that it exploded a latent psychological issue, and then it ruined their life. I mean, these things happen, and I mean, especially when you're talking about, I mean, talk about now, where are the resources for artists to go to if you have these issues? I'm talking about right now, not 1950 whatever, and being, you know, living in a segregated apartheid society. Where do you go to deal with this stuff? I mean, it would probably be like, oh, well, man, just, you're okay, have another drink, you know,
or just
brush
play.
It off,
just
play. Yeah, you know, it would just be sort of like, you know, you got to be a man, you got to just, you know, do what you got to do, you know. So yes, he, but you got to look at the other context of, like, he gets to New York, he gets sideways with his record company, to where they're like, hey, we're going to start garnishing your wages because we want you to be a commercial artist. We want you to be the next Earl Garner. Well, I don't want to be the next Earl Garner. I want to be Phineas Newborn. Well, we don't care what you want to be. We want you to sell records, and we let you do Phineas Rainbow and the next record. You got your little – now you're going to do what we want. Okay? I'm reading a book right now about the mob and the connection between the mob and the music business. I mean, you're going to do what we want. I mean – or guess what, you know, things are going to be bad for you. And what happened to him was, you know, oh, you don't want to play ball with us? Well, guess what? You're not going to work. You know, you all the management team we put together for you, that's gone. And now we're garnishing your wages. We're taking money out of your pocket. And then his marriage goes south. Well, he has a nervous breakdown.
Well, there's a story that,
you know, and he has to leave New York.
There's a story
start over
that
in LA.
He had an agent that was very adamant about him going on a tour far away in Europe. And
right.
as soon as he got him to go, he ran off with his wife.
Right.
And,
I've heard that story.
Took everything out of the apartment. He and the wife took everything out of the apartment and left them. When he came back, when Phineas returned, there was only a piano.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, how would you handle that? I mean, the pressures of that, being young, being new to this city, you know, I mean, it was overwhelming, obviously. And then maybe you have a mental health issue on top of that.
And a drug issue on top of that.
And maybe you're self-medicating, you know.
Another story that later in life, Atlantic wanted to do a new record with him. Fred Ford was going to help produce.
Yeah, the solo piano record?
Yeah. And amidst that, they asked, you know, would the record be able to get done in Memphis at Arden?
Right.
Or would he need to go to New York? And Phineas's mother intervening and saying, Phineas has said it would take $2,500 a week to finance Phineas's life in New York. But we still feel like New York is such a hazard to his right. psyche.
Of course.
That he wouldn't take it. So they tried it at Arden, and it didn't quite work. They sent $2,500, and he turned $2,500 down.
Right.
So, I mean, someone who, you know, between all these stories we were telling, has had multiple stints in various mental institutions and also had been beaten savagely.
Yes.
Multiple times.
And had his hands broken.
Yeah, from assailants that, you know, I don't think that they ever really figured
out. He was attacked by a group men, and they knew he was an artist, and they broke his hands brutally. They knew he was a pianist, and specifically smashed his hands. I actually heard that story from Jim Dickinson when I was like 16. I was a kid, friends with Luther and Cody, and Jim, we would like steal their dad's pot, and we'd hang out. And then his dad came down, and I think he knew we were doing it. And he came down, and he knew I was a jazz nerd. And he started telling me Phineas Newborn stories. And he told me that story, and he said that Phineas wouldn't go to the hospital. He'd only go to the psychiatric hospital here in Memphis because he knew it. He'd been there before.
He was a veteran. He'd go to the
VA. Right, yeah. VA or whatever. Yeah. And they didn't like set it right or something. Like Jim told me the story, like this is 30 years ago. I don't barely remember it. But like he said something about they set it wrong. So his hands were kind of jacked up. Like he still could play, but I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'd try to go back to the music and his genius and his brilliance and his exuberance. And like, yeah, there's a lot of tragedy there, man. And then I don't know if it speaks to like, cause I think it's easy to go, oh, well, he's a flawed man. You know, he's weak. And it's like, man, how would you deal with this? How would you deal with this?
On top of being brilliant.
And
I mean,
you're a genius, you know,
when you're brilliant and you have all this that you want to get out, that you want to in some orderly way, make real for people to share like beauty into the world, but there's commerce involved with that.
Yeah.
That is almost at adversity with it.
Sure.
You know, like how can we package all that amazing stuff and put it on a record that people will buy?
That's what RCA wanted
to
do.
Yeah. And so it's like we acknowledge that you're special, but we have to make McDonald's out of
yeah. I believe that. I think Earl Garner was an example that they might wanted to turn him into because he was a very successful artist, you know. And clearly, Phineas didn't want to do that. Also, I wanted to that point is like people like I've only met a couple. There's not many of these guys, but like the one if you do, I've met a man. I played with this one guy on Beale Street. Man, his name is Andre Stockard. Perfect Pit. Y'all know Andre? Anybody? Man, this dude. He hears music. It's like boom, right there. And, like, cats like that, they feel more than you do. Like, the average, you know what I mean? Like, they feel things, like, it's more intense. It's like everything's up, you know, times. That's why he does that. That's why he's able to do this stuff. Because he's absorbing information on a much bigger level. And so when the information is like, hey, man, you need to do this and you need to do that. We need to make money. And, hey, and then now we're going to put you into an institution. And now we're going to do shock therapy. And now we're going to fill you up with drugs. And there's all racism all around. I mean, what do you it's not that if you actually think about it, and you've and again, if you've been around artists of that, you know, near this caliber, it's a miracle actually lived as long as he did and did what he did actually.
Did
it's
so
actually a testament
records.
To his strength in a lot of ways that yeah. he made two records on Atlantic. He made four records on RCA. He made four records on Contemporary. He made, you know, like that's a pretty great body of work, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If we could come out of that and zoom out again to what I referred to earlier as a hidden history, for those who weren't at the last stereo sessions with, you know, a gallery of Memphis musicians who are important to jazz, and there aren't, not all of them are on that particular record, Young Men from Memphis. There are some who are after, some who are just a bit before. I mean, could we speak to this entire legacy? I mean, I think of people like a Mulgrew Miller, who was in a class of his own. Joyce Cobb. You know, I think yep. of Hank Crawford, who's not on that record. I think of so many incredible, Joe Restivo, ladies and gentlemen, give it up for him. Who?
Wow. I'm not in the conversation with those guys.
You are. I feel like, to be honest with you, just watching, you know, we went to Kansas City together a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Watching you just in your downtime mess around on the guitar opened my eyes and ears up to things that I hadn't considered before. How do we reclaim this history of jazz that belongs to our city? How do we elevate it without a banner like a Stax documentary or, shout out to David Less, who did a new record this past year with
yep.
young artists from Memphis who are carrying on a jazz heritage. Shout out to Jazz Heritage Month, where there's lots of programming this month to enjoy. And shout out to Stephen Lee and the young
Stephen
group
Lee, yeah.
of jazz musicians.
Jazz
that
Workshop,
he is,
yeah.
The Jazz Workshop that he is bringing up. I mean, there are things that are happening. But how do we connect it all and tether it all so that we can tell this story in a responsible way?
I think a couple of things. One, 25 years ago, I went to a symposium at Rutgers that was on Booker Little. And I was like, I went to this thing. Booker Little's a great trumpet genius who died very young. It was an illness. I can't even remember what it was. It was just like a random illness, died very young, 22, 23. And what was it? Blood disease. Thank you, David. And he left an incredible, just in the short amount of time, he left an incredible testament to his genius. But I went to a thing at Rutgers, and like, I'm here, like, they're talking about this Memphis musician at Rutgers University. All these, like, brilliant professors have come from all over the world. And I'm like, why aren't we doing this in Memphis? What's wrong with us? Why are we talking about this guy? So to answer your question, we're doing it right now. We're doing that right now. That's pretty cool. Like, because I don't think we were doing this stuff 20 yeah. years ago. So that, and I think education.
Yeah.
I think doing the radio stuff, you know, I'm trying to do what David's trying to do, give young people an opportunity, what Steve Lee's doing, trying to get young people an opportunity.
I'll make another note for Kirk Whalum, of course.
Kirk Whalum.
Donald Brown. I mean, so many people who deserve recognition.
But, you know, and I know what I was going to say. The last thing is this. I think one thing we do, and it's, I understand it, it's part of this sort of commercial aspect, sort of like a transactional. This music, y'all, anybody hip to Nicholas Payton, who's a trumpet player from New Orleans, he calls this stuff Black American. He doesn't like the word jazz. He will not use it. And here's what I like about his idea of BAM. It's like, it's all connected. It's not like, a lot of these folks didn't think, if you read their story, they're not thinking of it as a separate thing. Because we keep going, oh, jazz is over here. This is this. And this is, you have to be smart. And you got to be da-da-da. Man, that's not where the music came from. Music came from New Orleans with people like at fish fries and dance parties. Like people, working people were having fun. This was dance music. This was celebration music. This is party music. It's party music. Once you change that and go, well, no, you have to be this to do that. This is about being fancy. That's where it to me, it ruins it. And a lot of the institute, like a lot, I went to a fancy school, and it was like, is this good? I mean, in some ways it is, because it, yes, it does require a tremendous amount of work and study. Yes, that's true. But once you separate it from the people in these ways, through these institutions, through commercial elements, I think it can hurt the music. So let's bring it back to where it was. It's connected to gospel music, because you heard that, you hear gospel music in him. You hear the blues deep in this man's work. You know, you hear he knew how to play. He played for parties. He played for, you know, he wasn't just like, but he also had, yeah, I can sit down and play a, you know, Chopin Nocturne too, you know, but it's all to him, it's all part of a continuum. The cats like this, they don't see any difference between playing a Beethoven sonata and playing with B.B. King. It's not. It's music. How does it make you feel? Does it make you feel happy? Does it make you feel sad? Then that's art. That's all it is. It's not about anything else than that. Connecting, you know.
For sure. So, are y'all ready for side two?
Side two. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I want to point side two. Wait, real quick. Because side two starts off with a piece called Clarice, and the record they say is a Phineas composition, but if you read the Jamil Nasser book, he actually wrote that tune. So Clarice is another, you know, up-tempo modern jazz piece that was written by Jamil Nasser. Then a beautiful ballad by George Shearing called She, which I haven't found too many other examples of. So it's a very rare recorded piece. Ten Ten Dio is next, which is a trio piece, which is a very Latin Chano Pazzo piece. Dizzy Gillespie, is a Dizzy Gillespie big band tour de force. Phineas Newborn loved Dizzy Gillespie. He recorded Manteca, World of Piano, and he recorded this. So he's a huge Dizzy Gillespie fan. Autumn in New York, which is a great ballad. We loved it because he was in New York. Hey, we'll do Autumn in New York, one of my favorite songs.
Charles Lloyd performed that as well, didn't he?
One of my favorite songs about New York. And then he ends it, man, the last song on the record is crazy. Tour de force. He starts off so, it's What Is This Thing Called Love, which is like a tune every jazz musician knows. It's like a jam session tune. Like if you go to a jam session, what do you want to play? What Is This Thing Called Love? Everybody knows it. But he turns this thing into like a theme and variations, like Rachmaninoff. So theme and variations, you take a little idea and you just wear it out. You just keep changing and morphing and growing, reducing, whatever. So he does What Is This Thing Called Love? And he's like doing all that. And then the full band comes in with Philly Joe on the drums, and it's like cooking. That's how they end the record. It's fantastic.
Note of, Jim Spake just walked in. Another fantastic
Jim Spake, let me of this borrow the Jamil Nasser book. Thank you, Jim.
Fantastic.
Thank y'all. Appreciate y'all.
Let's do it.